long flights hot and thirsty, and headed straight for the nearest brew pub for local beer and burgers. Then, for middle culture, we found local sports events, maybe a wooden bat baseball tournament. On the high culture end, we sometimes searched for a cosmic experience of sorts, at one of the sanctuaries or sacred spots that America offers, in its natural parks and rivers and lakes, deserts, mountains, plains, and forests. As visitors, we enjoyed the silence in the simple design and the experience of walking around the confluence circles and sitting on the stone ledges. And we wished we could camp in one of the little cabins in the park, which other people had figured out a way to do. To make my experience more personal, I took a dive into the Snake River once we were back in Clarkston. It was very cold, and I had to swim against the current. But just as I had once dashed quickly over the rocky shore into the Bering Sea on a dare from one of our sons, I jumped in here, figuring it could again be a now-or-never chance for the adventure. We flew on through Idaho to Montana, with its places of rugged, nature-inspired names like Bitterroot, Sweetgrass, and Beartooth. When we're flying, our first impressions of an approaching town come at an altitude of about 2,500 feet above the ground. While Jim is busy landing the plane, and not noticing much except where the runway is and how he's lining up with it, I have a chance to look down at the layout of the town, at the grid of streets, or the line of the train tracks, or the course of a river, or the surrounding farmlands, hills, or forests. As we descend slowly for landing, I might count the number of backyard swimming pools, above ground or below, or see how many cars are in the factory parking lots, or trace the angled geometry of mobile home parks, or of new housing developments, or scope out schools and the amenities of their athletic facilities. Sometimes there are surprises, like the unmistakable smell of Kansas feedlots that wafts straight into the plane 1,000 feet up on a hot day, or the almost eerie silence on the radio when there is no one out there, anywhere, responding to our announcements of intentions to land. We've landed on runways that were little more than a skinny, patched stretch of tarmac with tufts of stubborn weeds, and, at the other extreme, a one-time Air Force base with runways so long you could have a picnic on one end and not worry about planes landing on the other. Second impressions for us come on the ground. The airports are usually, but not always, a little distance out of town. The least pleasant drives into town pass the indistinguishable strip malls of generic Dollar and Quick Mart stores. We could be anywhere. The best drives are along farms and woods that suddenly give way to a downtown. Then we know we're somewhere. The approach toward Chester, Montana was unique. We flew over jagged mountains, which then rolled away into the high plains with fields of green, yellow, and gold. The rivers below us meandered. The rail tracks, arrow straight for long stretches, looked efficient and important. The roads were few. In the skies, we flew for hours without sighting another plane. We were going to visit a Chester native and college friend, Phil Auberg, and his wife, Patty. Phil offered to collect us at the Little Chester Airport, and we gave him an ETA. He said he would listen for the plane as we flew over, then hop into his truck to fetch us. Indeed, he did exactly that, arriving quickly enough to watch us land. As we flew over Chester, it was just as Phil described, a no-stoplight town on the Great Northern Railway tracks. Several square blocks of buildings with the airport hugging the western edge of downtown. We were over it in a blink. I spotted Phil's old school, the pool, the grain silo, the tracks, and roughly where Phil and Patty lived with their son Jake, in the same house where Phil grew up. Phil is pretty much a Montana living treasure. With his full white beard and outdoorsman bearing, it would be tempting to call him gruff if he weren't actually closer to a teddy bear in real life. Already a serious music student as a young teenager, he would ride the train every few weeks to meet with his piano teacher in Spokane, a 7-hour trip, or 10 if there were lots of stops. Today he's a pianist and composer, with a collection of awards, performances, and collaborations that more than prove his bona fides to anyone who hasn't yet had the good fortune to hear his music. A Windham Hill Records contract, nominations for Grammys and an Emmy, and some 20 albums with names like From the Ground Up and Live from Montana. He built a studio in the back of his house from a metal grain silo. We all went kayaking one afternoon on the Marias River, an expedition that began gently, with dreams of even a dip in the water, but turned surprisingly and quickly into a dramatic paddle-for-your-life ordeal as a fierce windy storm blew in. The hills right up to one side of the water's edge seemed steeper, and the marshy banks on the other seemed farther away and less hospitable. But you know we survived. When Jim and I left Chester, we flew east toward the American Prairie Reserve, APR. We landed in Malta, about a two-hour drive from the reserve. The trek in reminded us of an earlier time in Gansu Province in China, when we went in search of the town of Yellow Sheep River, where we were going in to visit a small Buddhist boarding school for the children of the remote villages. We flew for 2.5 hours from Beijing to Lanzhou, then drove 2 hours to Yellow Sheep River, then continued overland until the road ran out, and went on to the school by horse and finally by foot. At the end of that hot, dusty journey, the school children presented us with white silk scarves, the traditional Buddhist offering to guests. This time in Montana, the paved road ran out before we reached our lodgings in the American Prairie Reserve, but we bumped along the dirt and potholes, grateful that rains had not made our route impassable, as we'd heard sometimes happens. The APR is an ambitious long-term attempt to return an enormous stretch of North American grassland to its original flora and fauna. During our days at the APR, we hiked on the prairie, straining to see the vistas all the way to the edge where the earth curved. We watched grazing bison up close, peered into the holes dug by tiny prairie dogs, who had emerged to stand on their hind legs as brazen as grizzlies, only in miniature. We stayed up late, hoping to see the northern lights. Alas, no luck. We trekked to a giant boulder left by an ancient glacier, named Indian Lake Medicine Rock, in the middle of the flat prairie. Millennia before us, someone, or several someones, had ventured repeatedly to painstakingly etch petroglyphs into the stone, and others more recently had left small offerings, an arrowhead, a striated stone, a tiny replica of a bison, balanced on the flat parts of the rock. All we could hear that day was the wind. We went up the small mountain to the buffalo jump, trying to imagine the scene when the Plains Indians enticed some of the local herd to leap hundreds of feet over the cliff's edge to their deaths. Meriwether Lewis described in his journal how it worked. A man disguised in a buffalo skin waited between the herd and the edge of the cliff. Bands of his fellow Indians hid, completely surrounding the back and sides of the herd. When the Indians jumped up, startling the herd, the decoy would run ahead, leading the bison to the edge, then slip out of the way into a sheltered cranny as the buffalo pounded forward, leaping over the edge.
The American Prairie Reserve, Montana. The American Prairie Reserve is not a town. Indeed, it does its best to put urban influences far in the distance, so that at night the sky has the deep blackness, broken by pinpoint clarity starlight that you cannot experience within 50 miles of a big town. On the drive south from the nearest tiny airport in Malta, we saw a few blocks worth of western downtown, then a mile or two of residential neighborhood, then farmland, mainly with grazing cattle, then mile upon mile of prairie. As we drove south toward the Missouri River and rolling plains and prairie, that in many vistas was, as we had seen at Chief Timothy Park, like what Lewis and Clark would have seen when they traversed this land more than 200 years before. That so much of this land still looks so much the way it once did, despite the paved roads, despite the fences for grazing, despite the dams that have been placed across the vast Missouri River, despite the dislocation of the tribes that once lived here to two large reservations, Fort Belknap and Fort Peck, is the idea behind the civic innovation underway in this part of Montana. Although it's not in a city, I use the term civic because in several unmistakable ways, what was happening on the American Prairie Reserve resembled what we had seen in urban and small town venues throughout our travels. People who had developed a connection to an out-of-the-way part of the country decided to invest their energy, resources, and even their working lives here. On problems that loom large, nationally and internationally, they felt they were making progress. We figure that we are maybe one-third of the way along the timeline. Sean Garrity, a Montanan who had returned from a career in Silicon Valley to run the reserve, told us about the work he and his colleagues had done for more than a dozen years. I enjoy the long timeline and thinking how this will look in 20 or 30 years. This is not a wish you often heard expressed in national politics. And the people behind the American Prairie Reserve were being creative, nonpartisan, public-private, working with businesses and ranchers and scientists and leaders of the neighboring tribes to realize their vision, which was nothing less than creating a natural reserve on the scale of the Serengeti National Park, in which the wildlife of the pre-settlement era would again prevail. The ecological story behind the American Prairie Reserve was a scientific determination around the year 2000 that there were only four extensive grassland areas in the world that had never been plowed or reaped by mechanical harvester, and thus, in principle, might have their original plant and animal ecosystems restored. One was in Kazakhstan, another in Patagonia, and a third in Mongolia, and all three of those were shrinking as farming intruded on their borders. The fourth was in Montana, in the central region of the state due north of Yellowstone Park in Wyoming, and was more intact than any of the others. Part of this land along the Missouri River already enjoys protection as part of the Charles M. Russell National Wildlife Refuge, which was established under Franklin Roosevelt and is named for a famous Western landscape artist. Land to the west is protected as a component of the Upper Missouri Breaks National Monument, which was established under Bill Clinton and is named for the dramatic limestone escarpments in this Badlands territory along North America's longest river. Some of the other nearby land is owned by ranchers, nearly all of whom graze cattle in parcels separated by barbed wire fences, and the rest by public agencies, from the Bureau of Land Management to the Fish and Wildlife Service. Much of this is leased out to ranching families on long-term and low-priced leases. Sean Garrity, the native, who has the tousle-haired, ruddy look of a sailor, described the first 20 years of his career through the 1980s and 1990s in Silicon Valley as the founder of a consulting firm that worked with companies like eBay and Cisco and Netflix. As the year 2000 neared, he was interested in getting out of the tech rat race and wanting to go back home, and he heard about a scheme to restore these Montana grasslands through the project now known as the American Prairie Reserve. "We tried to get started in 2001 and early 2002, Garrity told us, when we stayed with him at the lodge in the center of the reserve. But of course, that was the big tech recession, so we didn't really get any money until 2005. That was the start, when we bought our first piece of property. Buying land from private owners and taking it out of ranching is part of the American Prairie Reserve strategy. In the decades since that purchase, the organization has raised tens of millions of dollars, mainly from individual rich donors like the Mars family, which still privately owns the Mars Candy Company, and used it to obtain control of more than 300,000 acres of land. About a quarter of that is land it has bought outright from private owners. The rest is public land, on which it has taken over the lease and then taken the land out of grazing and converted it to wild use. Bit by bit, the parcels have been put together, the fences pulled out, and the strands of barbed wire removed, the migration paths re-enabled. Ultimately, the ambition is to assemble some 5,000 square miles of contiguous land, or about 3 million acres. This expanse, roughly the size of Connecticut, would be big enough to support diverse populations of species large and small, from prairie dogs and ferrets to bison, antelope, eagles, and wolves. The sweeping scale means, as Garrity put it, that you could stand in one place and see only prairie for 50 miles in any direction, and it would stretch another 50 miles beyond that. It would also give the species living there more options as heat and rainfall patterns change. You have to go big, Garrity said. You can have an ice sheet covering half this territory in bad winters, so the antelopes have to travel 80 miles away. You can have long-term drought, and the animals are very adaptable, but they need the space. All in all, the cost of assembling this land might come to $500 million by the American Prairie Reserve's estimate. Or, the comparison Garrity uses in almost every fundraising pitch he makes on visits to San Francisco, Seattle, or New York, about half as much as the cost of a new NFL-scale football stadium. The Dallas Cowboys Stadium cost about $1.1 billion to build. The MetLife Stadium for the New York Giants and Jets cost about $1.6 billion, or three times as much as the aspirational budget for the American Prairie Reserve. Fundraising is, of course, a familiar part of any vision for conservation, along with permanently removing land from commercial use. Groups like the Nature Conservancy have applied this strategy for decades. The Nature Conservancy is the recipient of the Dangermonds' $165 million gift to preserve coastal land in California. The more surprising part of the American Prairie Reserve approach is one that Garrity says comes from his tech industry experience. This is a way to cooperate with local ranchers to encourage them to work with rather than against the reserve's long-term goals. Many of the ranchers are from families who have run cattle on their fenced tracks for generations. Most of them are politically conservative. A noticeable fraction of them vocally resent the idea of outside money being used to make what they think of as their land a preserve or a showpiece. On the drive down from Malta, we passed at least a dozen anti-reserve signs in front yards and in pastures. They said things like, "Don't buffalo me, no federal land grab," or the words monument, reserve, wildlands, with a slash across all of them. Part of the friction is cultural. It involves resentment by people who feel that they have been the true stewards of the land, and that by raising cattle, they are helping feed the world's billions. We saw several large yard signs making this point, that without Montana beef, the United States would have a larger trade deficit and more customers overseas would be hungry. At least in one regard, time is very likely on the reserve side. Decade by decade, the farm population dwindles, and more of these ranches are likely eventually to go up for sale, and the reserve hopes to be able to buy them. In the meantime, Garrity and his colleagues are trying to address at least the economic conflicts between their plans and the ranchers' interests through economic incentives to make cooperation with the reserve worthwhile. The best known of these is a for-profit subsidiary of the reserve called the Wild Sky Beef Company. It guarantees ranchers a higher per-pound price for their cattle if they agree to a range of protective practices for wildlife. For instance, they can replace multi-strand barbed wire fences, which stop antelope as well as cattle, with fences designed to allow antelope to pass either over or under them. Also, they can stop poisoning and shooting prairie dogs, which ranchers view as a dangerous pest, since cattle can trip and break their legs by stepping into holes in so-called prairie dog towns, but naturalists consider an important part of the natural ecosystem and food chain of the prairie. Garrity said, as a model for some of his incentive plans, "In Sweden, the government told people in the countryside, if you send us a picture of a live wolf on your property, we'll pay you $300. All of a sudden, the wolves are a valuable commodity." With similar plans in Montana, he said, all of a sudden, as a rancher, your portfolio is broader and more valuable, and there are new assets you want to protect. In my previous life in the Silicon Valley, you were always late for something, for everything, Garrity said, as we were walking across the reserve on our last day there. You had to ship that product before the competitor down the street was first mover into that space. It could be anything. A pair of jeans, a new home loan concept, a chip. Everything is behind. And what's worse is that as soon as you shipped that thing, almost immediately, its perishable date began, like yogurt. It was this endless hurry. This project, he added, is 180 degrees different, and that is immensely satisfying. If we can make something happen, it will be permanent. When you add another piece of property, you can stop and think that 100 years from now, people will round that bend and see that view. It will be permanent. Nothing I ever did before can last in that way. 2016. Dodge City, Kansas. Deb and I celebrated America's birthday in a city that evokes a certain kind of America, namely Dodge City, Kansas. Over the years, we'd crossed the southern plains often enough to understand the lessons they provided in history, climate, and geography. When you head westward from the East Coast, you have a sense of going uphill and into drier air. Mile by mile, you leave behind the forested hollows of the Appalachian slopes, the farms and gently hilly pastures of southern Ohio and Indiana, the flatlands and sweeping corn and soybean fields of Illinois, which are broken at regular rectangular intervals by north-south and east-west roads laid out when the land was being distributed to 19th-century settlers. Across the thick and slowly serpentine Mississippi River and toward the broad brown Missouri, the land slowly rises. The vegetation becomes sparser and more burned out looking. Until, as you near the 100th meridian, the historic dividing line between the wet and dry parts of the American heartland, the only green areas in sight are the ones sustained by mechanical irrigators. I've heard people in airliners wonder about the circular green spots they see in the plain states. Farmers know they show the watering radius of a circular irrigating system. In Ohio, we look down on farm after farm with small man-made ponds popular for swimming, fishing, watering animals, and attracting wildlife. Water is too scarce for that farther west. At small airports, you see the effects of the westward progression as well. East of the Mississippi, airports usually have rope tie-downs where you can lash small planes like ours to the ground at three points, under each wing and at the tail. As you move into the plains and prairie, you stop seeing ropes and begin seeing chains to hold the planes down in what are usually stronger, constant winds. Coming the other way, from the front range of the Rockies eastward towards the Atlantic coast, there is the opposite sensation of sliding steadily downhill to wetter territory. The ground beneath you sinks in elevation. From more than 5,000 feet above sea level in the Colorado and Nebraska plains to a few hundred along the banks of the Mississippi. and the vegetation gets denser and greener by the mile. On this trip, we came up from the south, traveling across the plains of northern Texas and Oklahoma toward western Kansas. In the years I have flown this kind of airplane, I've landed it somewhere over 1,500 times. But every time, it commands my full attention as I bring the airplane from several thousand feet above the ground at a 200-mile-per-hour speed to the most benign return to ground level and low speed as I possibly can. About 30 miles from Dodge City, 10 minutes or so from arrival, we began the normal drill of preparation for landing. I tuned the plane's radio to get the AWAS or ATIS, the weather reports that are broadcast nonstop from an airport's weather monitoring station and that confirm which way the wind is blowing and which runway I should be heading for. I turned on the auxiliary fuel pump and adjusted the fuel flow setting from the fuel minimizing lean rate for cruise flight to its full rich level. That way, the engine would be ready for a quick, high-powered climb if we had to go around for another landing attempt because of an unforeseen problem on the runway. Birds, a deer, another plane taxiing out by mistake, a tractor using the runway as a shortcut to its mowing site. We'd seen them all and more. I double-checked the elevation of the airport itself, 2,600 feet above sea level for Dodge City, which is in the rising plains, so we could plan to be at pattern altitude, which is usually about 1,000 feet above the airport, or about 3,600 feet in this case. Since Dodge City is a controlled airport, with air traffic controllers in a tower, giving airplanes permission to take off or land, I listened on my second radio to ensure that communications with them would be clear. Of the some 5,000 airports within the United States, only about 600 have control towers. At all the rest, pilots rely on communications through their CB-style UNICOM frequency to learn who is where and to keep out of one another's way. At about the 30-mile point, I made contact with the tower at Dodge City. The air traffic controllers there told me how they wanted me to line up for an approach. Make left traffic, runway 32, report 3-mile left base, which meant setting up at 90 degrees to the runway, then making a left turn toward a landing as our plane aligned with it. And down we went from our cruising altitude of 8,500 feet, higher than on the East Coast because the ground itself was several thousand feet higher above sea level, toward the pattern altitude target of 3,600 feet at a gentle 500 feet per minute pace of descent. Part of my ritual for total immersion in the approach and landing process is to run through all the relevant numbers and specifications, often saying the results to myself aloud. We're at 5,500 feet, 2,000 feet to go until 3,500. We're at 120 knots at pattern altitude of 3,500 feet. We're lining up with runway 32 on final approach at 80 knots, and I see the numbers 32 at the threshold. The time this ritual seems most important is during an instrument approach in actual instrument conditions. That is, when you are pointing the plane downward through a cloud toward a runway you cannot see and amid terrain on either side that is also invisible. What keeps you safe is following the exact horizontal course and vertical descent path indicated by the dials in front of you as you bring the plane down, down, down until you reach the decision altitude. At that point, you have either broken clear of the clouds and can see the runway, or you must immediately climb out of danger in a missed approach. 1,200 feet going to 600, I will say aloud to myself when in a cloud following the glide slope down. If we descend to the decision altitude and the runway is not in sight, it's time to execute missed approach. I then shift the airplane into full power climb and tell the tower, 435 Sierra Romeo, going missed.
We landed in Dodge City just before the summer solstice. Temperatures hovered in the 90s and hot wind blew across the prairies, keeping the immense wind turbines that populate this land churning. Flying in from the south, we looked down on the harvest of the wheat fields, which had reached about the halfway mark, and the occasional oil wells. Over North Texas, we had seen roads cut through the fields by the farmers, ranchers, and oil drillers. In a Texas patriotic gesture, one road through the fields had been cleared in the unmistakable shape of that great state. Surely the rancher couldn't have seen that from his perspective, and it was slightly lopsided, but we appreciated his tipping the hat to travelers like us who, he knew, would fly over one day. Finally, we saw the small city, population about 30,000, materializing in the distance. The real sign that we had arrived in southwestern Kansas came as we taxied to park the plane. I cracked open the door to draw a breeze into the broiling cockpit. The breeze blew in a much stronger version of the pungent and unmistakable odor of cattle from the feedlots, which had made its presence known during our descent. The smell of money, as one Dodge City resident later remarked, a phrase I'm sure he had used 1,000 times before. We chatted with the folks at Kratz Aircraft, the FBO where we parked our plane, about the airplane paraphernalia decorating the lounge. With long distances across flat lands, we found the flying familiar and commonplace in this part of the country. Kratz called us a few mornings later to say that it looked like some weather, which in Kansas means bad weather, was coming, and offered to tow the plane from the tarmac into a hangar. That sounded like a good idea. Sure enough, around midday, something fierce blew toward Dodge. We watched it approach as we entered the new United Wireless Convention Center on the far west edge of the city, where the outskirts of the town's development stopped and 7 bison, including 3 new spring calves, grazed on the land. We had come to lunch on chicken fried steak and listened to the State of the City address by Mayor Joyce Warshaw, who itemized for an hour the many improvements and changes in Dodge City, from the arrival of the new commercial air service to Denver, to the city's 100% reuse of wastewater. The mayor had married into the Warshaw family of Dodge, early clothiers, who left their telltale imprint on the brick front of one of the retail buildings still standing on 2nd Avenue in town. To hang out in Dodge City is to be transported from one era to the next and back again. What put Dodge City on the map in the first place was cattle. Cowboys drove them up from Texas and in from the range to Dodge City, developed along the cavalry's existing Fort Dodge outpost. Then the railroads took live cattle or slaughtered cuts of meat onto markets in Chicago or farther east. Gunfighters, buffalo hunters, drifters, railroad builders, traders, no-nonsense women, and soldiers from Fort Dodge just up the road. That was Dodge City, Kansas, in the 1870s. Wyatt Earp, Bat Masterson, and Doc Holliday, they are some of the characters who passed through or settled there. It was a famously lawless town, with saloons, gambling, brothels, and shootouts. In a brief 15 years, the stuff of legends flourished and thrives even today as a tourist draw, especially among the Germans whose reruns of the 1950s TV series Gunsmoke have made a visit to Dodge City something of a pilgrimage. Fast forward 2 decades. Electricity, water wells, sewer lines, a fire department, graded streets, and telephones arrived. Then, in 1905, another milestone of gentrification. A group of distinguished Dodge City residents, including a doctor and a judge, Edmund Madison, later a U.S. congressman from Kansas, was inspired by the Women's Club of Dodge City to write to Andrew Carnegie requesting support to build a library. Carnegie was already building 5 libraries in Kansas that year, and he granted Dodge City $7,500 for theirs. The city commissioned an unusual design in what was called the free eclectic style with a rounded front, and the building was placed on a diagonal that still commands the corner view of Commercial Second Avenue. Today's Dodge makes the most of this heritage and the city's ongoing economic reality in ways as kitschy as the refurbished Long Branch Saloon and as elegant as the city's logo, a silhouette of a group of trail riders on their mounts, which is featured on the way into and out of town and on many street signs. It also copes with being one of those American cities that is still immediately in touch with the dirty, dangerous, harsh work on which a meat-consuming society is based, thus shaping much of its economic and civic life. "This is a beef town," several people said, with a tone of both pride and discomfort.
Modern-day Dodge City is a red part of one of the country's politically reddest states. In the 2016 election, just a few months after our visit, Donald Trump took 67% of the vote in Ford County, whose county seat and population center is Dodge City, versus just 27% for Hillary Clinton. But as with the political contrast and comparison of Burlington, Vermont, and Greenville, South Carolina, apparently opposite extremes in national politics that function very similarly at the local level, the red-blue categorization proves less valuable as a predictor of how people in this town deal with issues that are so poisonous at the national level, from immigration to environmental policy to the proper role of government. One example is taxes. In national politics and at the state level, Dodge's residents often vote for tax-cutting conservatives. Locally, they pin their city's long-term hopes on a daring tax increase plan. In 1997, the city's voters approved a permanent sales tax increase totaling 1%, with the proceeds to be used for long-term civic improvements. This is known as the Why Not Dodge initiative. Nearly everywhere you look in town, there's another project funded by the ongoing flow of Why Not Dodge revenues. They include a large public soccer complex, the Cavalier Field and Legends Park baseball and softball complexes, an auto raceway, a new civic center, a large expo site, a brand new aquatics park called the Long Branch Lagoon, which was in very heavy use during our visits, and repairs on a historic railroad depot. In effect, a very conservative community voted itself an open-ended tax to pay for long-term infrastructure improvements. Why was this possible here when its counterparts at the national level are gridlocked out of consideration? "We may be conservative, but we're progressive," Melissa McCoy, who grew up not far from Dodge City and is now the city's project development coordinator, told me. "There was a time when we had a really negative self-image as a town. But people thought, if we won't invest in ourselves, how can we expect anybody else to? It was a matter of getting the community behind it and realizing that we needed to back ourselves up to get outside investment and support. Now we're starting to see it pay off." I asked Mayor Warshaw whether there was any mystery or contradiction in a politically conservative community enacting a permanent infrastructure improvement tax. Warshaw is herself a Republican. She ran, but lost, in the GOP primary for the Kansas State Senate that year. "Not at all," she said. "It's been so beneficial for the city. This community is incredible in embracing things that need to happen for the city. I think many people saw how important it was to raise taxes just a minute little bit to raise our quality of life here in Dodge." Something similar was true of ethnic politics. Voters across Kansas and in Dodge City voted for candidates advocating a much tougher line on immigrants. In their own town, they operated very differently. The middle of the country is more of an immigrant magnet than you would guess, from most stories about flyover country. The cities and farms of the Inland America expanse from Buffalo, Pittsburgh, and Cleveland, across to Denver and the mining towns of the Rockies, attracted immigrant labor in the late 1800s. The cities, farms, and suburbs of interior America are doing so again now. Minnesota and South Dakota have been important refugee resettlement areas. Almost every sizable city in the Plain States in the Midwest now also has a sizable Hispanic population. The reasons for the migration differ region by region. In western Kansas, railroad construction drew a diverse workforce in the late 1800s, and now the meatpacking industry has done the same. In southwestern Kansas, it's easy to see the demographic age pyramid typical of areas undergoing rapid and ongoing immigration. That is, the younger the age bracket, the larger its Latino proportion. The school-age population of Dodge City is 70 to 80% non-white, mainly Latino. The town's population as a whole is more than half Latino. But the business and political leadership, mainly older members of longer established families, is mainly white. Nothing about this is surprising. Through the long history of U.S. immigration, the first-generation arrivals concentrate on economic survival, leading broader civic engagement to their children and grandchildren. This imbalance brings the obvious potential for friction and resentment of the sort given such clear voice during the 2016 presidential campaign. For instance, the school population looks very different from the people who are paying most of the school taxes and making decisions on the school board. But, as we've noted throughout this journey, the more ferocious the anti-immigrant passion, the more distant actual immigrants tended to be, and the more theoretical, and apparently the more frightening, their menace was. Put another way, in communities like those in western Kansas, whose economic vitality today and demographic prospects for tomorrow depend on attracting new residents, people have worked out a modus vivendi that resembles ethnic change through America's past. It has always involved strains, whether with the arrival of the Germans and the Irish in the 1800s, or the Italians and the Slavs at the start of the 1900s, or the Cubans and Filipinos in the middle of the 20th century, or the Vietnamese and Salvadorans near the end, or the groups that have arrived since. Over time, American society has absorbed and flexed and, in my view, benefited from being able to accommodate and assimilate newcomers more easily than any other advanced society. And that is how Western Kansas seemed to us. Dodge City had long had an ethnically mixed population because of workers who arrived during its cattle drive and railroad heydays in the late 1800s and afterwards. But its modern makeup began changing when the big packing houses started arriving in the early 1980s. The two major operations that dominate Dodge City's economy are those of Cargill Meat Solutions and National Beef. Packing house is a nicer term for what was once called a slaughterhouse, much as Meat Solutions is a nicer name for the company, and harvesting cattle is a nicer job description term for the work of putting animals to death one after another through the workday. We didn't push for a look inside the packing houses during our visits because I have seen places like them before and understand their reality. The economy that supports the packing houses defines Dodge City. The associated feedlots that ring the city and in which the animals spend the final months or weeks of their lives putting on weight. The trucks that roll in nonstop, bearing live animals into the huge buildings on the south side and carrying boxes of cut meat back out. And also the many thousands of people who earn their living inside. Something like a quarter of the beef eaten anywhere in the United States comes through the feedlots, packing houses and shipment centers of this corner of Kansas. Large quantities are also shipped overseas. The employees in these factories are nearly all immigrants. In the 1980s, a substantial number were recent arrivals from Vietnam. Now they're mainly Mexicans, or from Central and South America, plus an increasing number of Somalis and other Africans, plus some Southeast Asians and others. Pay rates vary, but are much above minimum wage. For instance, a current listing for a starting position in beef harvesting at Cargill offers $15.50 an hour, with medical and 401k benefits, in an area where living costs are very low. The work can obviously be unpleasant and extremely hard. A man who had been a manager for a large packing house in the area told us, "I can tell you that no matter what wages you paid, you are not going to find any reasonable number of native-born Americans who will do these jobs," he said. He preferred not to be identified. "Your Anglo community is not going to work there, pretty much regardless of the wage. The entire meatpacking industry," he said, "depends on immigrant labor, and always has." The syllogism we heard from him and many others was, without the meatpacking industries, these towns in western Kansas would have withered. Without immigrants, mainly from Mexico, the meatpacking and feedlot industry would not exist. The economic and cultural survival of places like Dodge City and Garden City depends on immigrants, some of whom arrive legally and many of whom don't. "There are some pockets of people here who are old school," the one-time packing house manager told us. "They'd like to take America back and so on. But by and large, people here, Anglo and Hispanic and otherwise, recognize that we're in this together. The immigrants are the engine that keeps this community alive." While we were in Kansas, we saw a study of the meat-based regional economy written by Brian Hansen, who works for a think tank called the Center for Rural Affairs. Here was his conclusion. Latinos and immigrants are not only bringing population growth to rural America, they are also bringing economic growth. Economists have found that nationwide, rural counties with larger proportions of Latino populations tend to be better off economically than those with smaller Latino populations. Rural counties with higher proportions of Latinos tend to have lower unemployment rates and higher average per capita incomes. In Dodge City, the unemployment rate is among the lowest anywhere in the nation, somewhere below 3%. The city has a permanent website listing open positions called DodgeCityHasJobs.com. You might argue about the direction of the causal arrows. Are immigrants drawn to areas that already have strong economies? Or do they make economies stronger by their presence? Probably some of both is true. But the result is unmistakable. Across much of the plains and the rural Midwestern region of the United States, what has kept communities alive is new arrivals, mainly from countries to the south. I spoke with Greg Rooley about the cultural side of the changed demographics in Dodge City. Rooley, who grew up on a farm in Iowa, is CEO of Servitech, a company that helps farmers across the plain states increase their yields while optimizing their use of fertilizer, pesticides, and water, using technologies that allow precision, foot-by-foot monitoring of growing conditions in the fields. Rooley said that he and his family, who had come to Dodge City 3 years earlier, found it a great place to live. "It's an interesting culture," he told me, "in part because there is such a big immigrant population here. We're halfway through our son's third grade year, and he was the only one in the family who knew the second verse to Feliz Navidad. And you know what? That will serve him well." "If you ask about the population here, there are two answers," Rooley told me. "There's the documented population," that's one number. "The second number includes the undocumented population, which is bigger. We just don't know how much bigger. But Dodge City has found a way to make this work, he said. No one fought it in the schools. I'm a pretty conservative guy, but I think we have to keep finding a better way to integrate this diverse population into our economy. If I say it in conservative circles, I might run the risk of somebody heating up the pot of tar to tar and feather me. But it's the reality of our town. An Anglo former meatpacking employee we met late in our stay summed up what we had heard from others. The reality here in southwest Kansas is that we are heavily influenced by the Hispanic culture, and not just economically, he said. They are part of the fabric of our community. If they decided to pack up and leave, Dodge City would be a ghost town. And we realize that the future success of the Hispanic community predicts the future success of the community as a whole. One of those arrivals is Ernestor de la Rosa. When we met him, Ernestor was the assistant finance director and assistant to the city manager of Dodge City, and a spark plug of civic life there. He is a handsome, slightly built man in his early 30s, most striking on first impression because of his large, dark eyes. If you listened carefully to De La Rosa for a minute or two, you could pick up clues that English was not his first language. But you would have to be listening closely. When Ernestor De La Rosa arrived in the United States at age 13, he did not speak or read English at all. He was born and raised in Mexico and first came to the States on a visitor visa. Other members of his family were already in Kansas working in meatpacking plants. He eventually joined them in Dodge City, finished high school and then college, got a master's degree in public administration at Wichita State University, the innovative leading school in this part of the plains, and came back to Dodge City. Starting in 2000, De La Rosa and other members of his family got in the queue for a green card. 16 years later, he was still waiting. But he was able to work in the United States now because of DACA, or Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, the Obama administration's 2012 executive order that allows people who arrived before age 16, as De La Rosa did, to get renewable work permits and be exempt from deportation while the U.S. government figures out some longer-term reform to its immigration policy. Of course, this policy was one of several that Donald Trump proposed changing as part of his crackdown on immigration. When I arrived, I was still a kid and didn't think about what was happening, De La Rosa told us. I didn't think, I'm going to a different country, I need to learn a different language. I didn't think about any of that. More than anything, I was enthusiastic about my family and the schools and the help I got here. I couldn't be here now as a city official, a prominent young member of the city's new ethnic majority, without the help and encouragement of my teachers when I arrived. I asked De La Rosa whether he consciously thought of himself as part of a transition in the Latino community's local role. We already have many leaders working in many sectors, he said, but I am hopeful that there will be more and more. If people see me working for the city, it might encourage others to step up. They might think, I could do that too. We'd like to encourage young families to participate more in city and county affairs and be more represented in all local events. What did he think when he heard the build a wall chants, which, by the way, were a more typical feature of rallies in New Hampshire or Michigan than of those in places where arrivals from Mexico had mainly congregated? When we hear things like this, he answered, it just sounds so irrelevant. It's not the story we are seeing here in Dodge City at all. Our people here work, he said. They want to establish themselves here in Dodge City. They want to raise their families and have a future. It's unfamiliar to us, these comments being made on the national level. We are doing everything we can to integrate the newcomers and their families. I asked De La Rosa about his long-term ambitions. He said that eventually he hoped to become a city manager in Kansas or elsewhere. He said, "I'd like to continue to help my community and encourage our Latino and other immigrants that you can do these things even if you don't start with the proper documentation. I'd like to encourage them to pursue their dreams."
When I first arrived at Dodge City High School, I headed straight for the lake. That would be Demon Lake, the acre-sized pond at the side of the school grounds where students practice their catch-and-release techniques on bluegill, catfish, and bass. Fishing in landlocked Dodge City, Kansas? No problem. With hefty funding from the Kansas Department of Wildlife, Parks, and Tourism, a lake was made with reclaimed wastewater and stocked with fish. I had never heard of high school fishing before, not even in my hometown high school, in a fishing town on the south shore of Lake Erie. Jackie Feist, the DCHS principal, and her associate principal, Mike Martinez, met me on that hot late June morning. Except for the brief diversion of some fire trucks responding to a false alarm, things were pretty quiet at the school. Some summer courses hosted a small number of students. Feist and Martinez described their school's operating principle: kids first, then teachers, then administration. Martinez said he wants this school to be a place where the kids can be themselves, adding, "If five or six kids are interested in snakes, we'll start a herpetology club and they'll be crawling in caves." The school website lists more than 30 activity groups, from an animation club to a student-run business to the Demon Outdoor Club, which includes not only fishing, but clay target shooting and archery. Beyond those activities, the school curriculum with its 16 career clusters whets kids' appetites in everything from welding to foreign service to communications. The point of all this, Feist and Martinez explained to me, is to give every kid a place at the school and a sense that their interests, whether snakes or fish or art, matter and belong at the school. Translation? The students themselves belong at the school. The result? Demon pride. Much of the reason that this inclusion works, according to Feist and Martinez, is the common ethic of the faculty and administrators and their solid grounding with Dodge City and its schools. Most of the adults at the high school have invested their lives and careers in the school and the community. Feist, who exudes energy, has been at Dodge City Schools for 3 decades. Martinez, who looks impossibly young to claim it, has been there for 2. There is little turnover among teachers, many of whom are homegrown or from nearby. Only one of the 12 new teachers hired that year was from out of state. One measure of faculty and staff dedication? DCHS made history in 2016 by claiming the Kansas Teacher of the Year honor for the 2nd year in a row. A larger-than-life-size poster of the 2 winning teachers standing back-to-back, math teacher Justin Coffey and biology teacher Shannon Ralph, greets you in the school entry. In his own category, the 12-year veteran school bus driver, Eduardo Escobedo, won the top transit class school bus driver at the Kansas School Bus Rodeo Safety Competition. The history of the student population is very different from that of the staff. Since the late 1980s, the demographic composition of Dodge City students has dramatically changed. According to one estimate we heard from city officials, the Hispanic population in grades K through 12 would have been about 20% in the 1980s and is nearly 80% today. First Mexicans, then waves of others from Central American countries like El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala. Dodge City is, in effect, a port of entry, says Robert Vinton, the director of the Dodge City Migrant Education Program, even though it is nearly 700 miles north of the border. The high school is about 70% Hispanic, with another 7% designated as other, which includes African and Asian immigrant populations. The rest are Anglo. In the high school, 36% of students are English language learners. But now hear this. The heavily Anglo-voting population